and the Blessed One, together with a large company of bhikkhus, went to the further bank of the river Hiranyavati, to the Sala Grove of the Malas, in the vicinity of Kusinara. And there he spoke to the Venerable Ananda, saying, "Please, Ananda, prepare for me a couch between the twin Sala trees with the head to the north. I am weary, Ananda, and want to lie down." "So be it, Lord." And the Venerable Ananda did as the Blessed One asked him to do. And then the Blessed One lay down on his right side in the lion's posture, resting one foot upon the other, and so disposed himself mindfully and clearly comprehending. At that time, the twin Sala trees broke out in full bloom, though it was not the season of flowering. And the blossoms rained upon the body of the Tathagata and dropped and scattered and were strewn upon it in worship. And celestial Mandarava flowers and heavenly sandalwood powder from the sky rained down upon the body of the Tathagata and dropped and scattered and were strewn upon it in worship. And the sound of heavenly voices and heavenly instruments made music in the air out of reverence for the Tathagata. There's sometimes pictures you see of this scene in Far East Asian Buddhism, a giant Buddha with many flower petals strewn all around and all kinds of reverential deities and whatnot flying around. So close your eyes for a moment and imagine this. Flowers falling from the sky, the heavenly music softly playing, and the Buddha peacefully resting, mindful and clearly comprehending. In other words, not just aware, but understanding exactly what's happening. At that time, there was a monastic named Upavana who was standing in front of the Buddha, fanning him. And the Buddha told him to move. And Ananda thought, "Gee, this is a little harsh for poor Upavana. He's only trying to help. Why is the Buddha telling him to move? I wonder why. Why isn't the Buddha sensitive to him and, you know, in this time and appreciating the gift?" So Ananda said, asked the Buddha, "You know, why is that? Why did you tell him to move?" And the Buddha said, "Well, I had to ask him to move because there are a lot of devas flying around in the Sal Grove. So many devas that you cannot wave the point of a hair. Like if you had a hair and you tried to put it somewhere, you couldn't put it anywhere without poking a deva. That's how many devas there are in the air, and these devas are all grumbling, saying, you know, we came here all this way from the heavenly realms to see the wonderful, rare, and important sight of a Buddha leaving this world, and now here's this big, clumsy monk, Upavana, fanning away, standing in our way, and we can't see what we came all this way to see, and that's why I asked Upavana to move," the Buddha said, "out of courtesy to these deities, these devas, or devas, I guess is the way you pronounce it, even though it's pronounced with a written with a V." So Ananda then, you know, hearing this, looked around and said, gee, I don't see any devas. What kind of devas are you seeing? And the Buddha said, sky devas, earth devas, all kinds of devas. And they're all weeping and tearing their hair and throwing themselves onto the ground in their grief. Ananda then asked the Buddha about funeral arrangements. And the Buddha said, Ananda, you monastics, you have your job cut out for you already. You have to strive for awakening. You don't have time to worry about funerals. Let the various classes of lay people who are devoted to me take care of the funeral. And Ananda said, but what should we do with the remains? And the Buddha said, you should treat my body just like the body of a king. Wrap it in cloth, 500 layers thick. Put it in a big iron vat, make a funeral pyre, and using all kinds of perfumed woods, cremate the body and raise up a stupa for the ashes in a crossroad shrine. So Ananda, now having received all the necessary instructions, went off by himself to his hut, and he was leaning on the doorpost, lamenting. What am I going to do, he thought. I'm not yet awakened, as we've been studying. You know, Ananda is always unenlightened. I'm not yet awakened. And here my teacher is about to leave me. And knowing what Ananda was thinking, the Buddha called him back over and said, Ananda, you know that death comes to everyone. Don't worry. And then he said to the monks there assembled, every Buddha in the past has had an Ananda, just like Ananda. And every Buddha who will ever live in the future will have an Ananda, just like Ananda. Ananda, he went on, has four remarkable qualities. When people come to see Ananda, they are always pleased to look at him because Ananda was famous for being very good looking. That's why he was always falling in love with people and they were falling in love with him, because he was a good-looking young fellow, you know. So everyone always, whenever people saw Ananda, they liked to look at him. It encouraged them. The second, when Ananda talks Dharma to them, this makes them happy. They get very enthusiastic whenever he talks Dharma. And third, when he doesn't talk Dharma to them, they're very disappointed. I haven't checked again, but the last time I checked, even though the Buddha said there are four things, there are only three that I could find. Anyway, I should go back and check again. Maybe the other one is lurking somewhere. Maybe it wasn't there at the time, but it appeared later. I don't know. But I don't think there's a fourth thing. There's only three things listed in the text. And it's kind of interesting that the Buddha is not consoling Ananda. When Ananda laments, you know, he doesn't say, well, don't worry, you're going to awaken eventually, pretty soon, don't worry. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, well, yes, I may be passing, but you'll find other teachers that are just as good, don't worry. He doesn't say any of that. He tells him instead that he is perfect and special, just as he is. He tells them that forever, throughout the past and in the future, every Buddha will always have an Ananda, just like that. And the unique position of being Ananda, the unenlightened, clueless, comical, funny, messy Ananda, has always and will always exist in relation to a Buddha, and that people will always love Ananda just the way he is. Then the Buddha told Ananda to go into the town where the Malas lived and tell the Malas that all that night, in the last watch of the night, the Buddha will attain Parinibbana. And when they heard this, they all went to the Sal Grove and they gathered around for the vigil, waiting for the end of the Buddha's time on earth. At that point, an ascetic named Subhadda, who had heard about the Buddha's passing, appeared, asking for instructions. And Ananda tried to tell him, no, this is not really the time, you know. You never met the Buddha before, and look, this is, got all these devas around and all these people around, and I think this is not the right time. But the Buddha said, no, okay, it's all right, let him come over. And then the Buddha and Subhadda had a chat. Every conversation with the Buddha always ended in the same way. The person, well, not everyone, but many conversations with the Buddha ended in the same way. The person in the conversation said, oh my God, would you please ordain me right now? On the spot, I'm going to follow you forever. And that's what Subhadda said. And he was ordained in the presence of the Buddha, and he was the last disciple of the Buddha's lifetime. Then the Buddha said, okay, any final questions? And nobody said anything, by which the Buddha understood that there were no final questions and everyone knew exactly what to do. So he then said to them, all conditioned things are of the nature to pass away. Strive on untiringly. And these are the last words uttered by the Buddha. In entering parinirvana, he knew he was fulfilling his destiny, bringing to completion his great journey. As they say, doing what needed to be done, that he had done what needed to be done. And this is always a good feeling, right? To do what needs to be done. Don't you feel good when I did what needed to be done? I brought what I set out to do to completion. So the Buddha must have had a lot of contentment in that time. Then the Buddha entered the first jhana, the first jhanic state, the first concentration state, from which he entered the second and the third and the fourth. After that, he entered the concentration of infinite space, then the concentration of infinite consciousness, then the concentration of nothingness, and then the concentration of neither perception nor non-perception. And at that moment, Ananda said, the Buddha has passed away. But the great Aniruddha, who was also present, said, no, Ananda, that's not right. The Buddha has not passed away. Because he actually had not yet passed away. Then the Buddha went backwards from the concentration of neither perception nor non-perception to the concentration of nothingness, and so on, all the way back to the first jhanic state. And then again, intensifying concentration, going forward again to the second, the third, the fourth jhana. And from the fourth jhana, the Buddha left this world. His consciousness released, his binding unbound, his limitations transcended. And at that moment, as you can well imagine by now, there was a hair-raising earthquake accompanied by terrible thunder. And then spontaneously the various gods and the most enlightened monks and nuns recited verses, spontaneously composed, marking the moment. So when you think about it, it's kind of interesting that the sutra goes through all this, because How could anyone have actually known the various meditative states through which the Buddha passed, right? Who could know? It's like when I've seen you sitting there, oh, I see she's now in the third jhana, now she's in the fourth jhana. No, how could you tell, right? It's kind of funny. Who knew? On the other hand, Aniruddha was famous for being like the greatest meditator of all time. And he had, as such, special powers. So maybe it's because of Aniruddha who did know, could tell, you know, all the different states the Buddha's in. Maybe that's how we know all this. And notice that when the Buddha entered the neither perception nor non-perception state, Ananda looked at him and was certain that he was dead, because in that state there's no breathing. So it looks like a person has passed away. And that's why Ananda thought the Buddha was dead. It also would explain how someone could not hear 500 carts rambling by when they were meditating in that jhanic state, or could not hear earthquakes and thunder and so on, as we were saying earlier today, I guess, or yesterday, whenever it was. As you are aware, I'm sure, these eight jhanic states are mentioned again and again in the sutras. They are defined in various places. They were pre-Buddhist forms of meditation, and also apparently, although there's debate about this, they were practiced in the Buddhist time, and he recommended them. And they are mentioned again earlier in a part of the sutta that I didn't quote. And I'm sure all of us old-time meditators know about the jhanic states and have experienced them to some extent at some time or another in the sitting practice that we've done. These states progress, if that's the word, from states that are initially very pleasant and blissful, and you can feel the bliss and the pleasure in the body. You know, where there might have been pain in the body, aches and pains, all of a sudden it goes away and you just feel just so wonderful to just breathe and be present. But it progresses from there to states that are beyond knowing and enjoying, where there is no thought at all or no emotion, but instead a kind of deep equanimity beyond equanimity, all the way to these more mysterious concentrations like or jhanas, like infinite space, nothingness, and so on. The debate about, you know, probably you're aware of this, that there are some people who feel that it's important to cultivate the jhanic states, and they're certainly kind of interesting if you're into meditation, right? This is pretty interesting. But I think a lot of Buddhist teachers, I think Thich Nhat Hanh was very famous for forthrightly saying jhanic states, all these jhanic states are unnecessary. We just need enough concentration so that we can have true insight. We don't need all this extra concentration. But some teachers do. One of my teachers that I really loved a lot, who was a wonderful person, Ayakema, she was a great lady, and she was very big on the jhanic states, and her disciple, I forgot his name now? Lee learned from her, and he also carries on her. She was a kind of wonderful person who was like very insistent on what she thought, you know, and so she was very... She was like, no, that's wrong. This is it. So Lee carries on that tradition of the jhanas from her. So I would say, yes, we need to have some meditation practice, but we don't necessarily, in my opinion, need to systematically worry about the jhanic states. But the thing is, if you sit, and you sit diligently over some period of time, it's almost, it's highly unlikely that elements moments of these jhanic states won't arise. They spontaneously arise, whether or not you're trying to cultivate them. If you're just trying to sit and pay attention, once in a while, they do arise. Not necessarily as organized or sequentially as they appear in the texts, but they do arise by accident. Anyway, you might have expected, wouldn't we expect, that the Buddha would enter Parinirvana through the portal of the deepest of the concentration states? Wouldn't you think? Yeah, he'd go all the way to the end, and then when he got to the end, fly away. But no. He goes to the end, he comes back, he goes back, and when he's right about in the middle of the possible depth of concentration, at that point, he lets go. So you might wonder, was he just sort of wandering around until he found the right spot? Or was it necessary that he goes to the deepest place and comes back in order to, you know, what are we to think of this? And is any of this really true? Does anybody know? Where did that all come from anyway? In the Mahayana Sutras that I referred to in the very beginning, instead of eight jhanas, you get the feeling like there are an infinite number of jhanas. They name the concentration states, and they list, in some sutras it's very amusing, they list page after page after page after page of named concentration states, with names like Great Luminous Moon Concentration State, Endless Light and Heavenly Trembling Concentration State, Great Fragrant Mandarava, flower, petal, concentration state. We have this word state, which might imply a steady experience that lasts for some time. And sometimes we do have a jhanic state that lasts for a while and is very surprising and pleasant. But sometimes a concentration state flashes through in less than a moment, flash of a moment, and maybe you hardly notice. Anyway, the Buddha was familiar with all this practice. He practiced, after all, his whole life. So when he was leaving the world, naturally he entered these familiar states. They were so ingrained in him that other things that might have appeared to his consciousness simply were knocked out by his strong familiarity with concentration states. It's interesting, from my point of view, especially, that he tells Ananda that it is not for monastics to worry about funerals. It's the lay people's problem. The monastics are only concerned with awakening. As you might be aware, in Japan, the source tradition for our Zen centers, priests are known for doing funerals and in general for being in the business of taking care of death. In Japan, where everybody practices every religion, you know, like we were talking the other day, here, like, if you were a Catholic, you don't go to the Protestant church, you know. If you're a Jew, you're not going to the mosque. Because we are not a Muslim, so you don't go to the mosque, right? You're not a Catholic, so you don't go to the church. But in Japan, they go everywhere, depending on the need. So if you have, if you want to pass your exam, you better go to the Shinto shrine and make an offering, and then you'll maybe pass the exam. If you're going to get married, go to the Shinto priest and get married. If you're dying or depressed, go to the Buddhists. That's their specialty. So that's why people maybe get a little superstitious and they don't like seeing Buddhist priests. Ooh, you get those people out of here. These Buddhist priests are very bad luck, you know, to see a Buddha. And if you're sick in the hospital and the Buddhist priest is coming, oh, wait, no, maybe not yet. I don't want to see the Buddhist priest. Thank you very much. So it looks like, at least in Japan, the recommendation for the monastics or the priests, the clergy, not to take care of funerals has not been followed. There is something good I've come to feel, because, you know, when I started practicing, I was certainly not at all. I was a young person, right? I was 22 or something, and I was not concerned about people dying in funerals. I was concerned about awakening, so I was sort of feeling just like the Buddha was saying there. But I've come to see that there is something good about Buddhists taking care of death, because it turns out death is very important to life, and it's very profound. But also there's something not so good about taking care of death. When you take care of death and memorial services a lot, it can't help but eventually become a kind of business. At the time of, you learn, and people in the religious world have learned long ago that in the name of my deceased spouse, mother, father, child, I'm happy to give very large donations to the temple in the name of my person. So it's almost impossible that taking care of death will not become a business. And when it becomes the main source of the temple's revenue, it eventually becomes more important than the practice and awakening. So that's why the Buddha said, let the lay people take care of this. Those concerned with awakening should not be in that business. And yet, it's my experience that people who have practiced a lot, and especially those who have made a lifetime commitment to practice, are best able to offer inspiration and comfort at the time of death and grief. And to offer this comfort is really a blessing. And it's a compassionate, beautiful service. And all religions have participated in this. In fact, this need to help at the time of death and grief might be one of the most important features of and reasons for spiritual practice to begin with. I always say, you know, if human beings didn't die, there wouldn't be religion. Mm-hmm. It's only because we die that we have religion. Animals don't have religion because they don't die. I mean, we know they die. We look at them and they die, but the animal doesn't think, oh my God, I'm dying now. You know, the deer who's hit by the car doesn't think, oh my God, I'm dying now. The deer just lives and then doesn't. There's no death. Death is a concept only human beings participate in, and therefore only human beings have religion and actually need it. They say, though, that in Japan, the funerary Buddhism, which was so embedded in the cultural matrix in which caring about ancestors from the past was so important, this is sort of breaking down slowly in Japanese culture, and the Japanese funerary Buddhism that's been going on for many, many generations is little by little falling apart. So no one knows what will happen. How will the priests support themselves? In our practice, everyday Zen practice in the United States and Canada and Mexico, unfortunately or fortunately, we find ourselves taking care of death more and more as all of us get older and older. When someone dies, if we are invited and welcome by the family, we will sit with the person in their last hours, keeping a vigil just like the malas kept a vigil with the Buddha. And we will continue to sit with the person after death. Nowadays, even in hospitals, they used to whisk the bodies away. And now if you ask them, if you say, may we please sit here with the body, despite the enormous expense of a hospital bed, they will allow you to do that for some hours, generally. And we do. If it's at home, we help wash the body and dress the body, and we open up the windows wide, bring in a fan so that we circulate air in the room. Sometimes people put flowers and herbs around the body. And we sit there for a while, and we provide space for friends to come and sit. Since we have gotten so used to death, we can sit there and make it possible for others to come and sit there who otherwise wouldn't if we weren't there, you know what I mean? We sort of normalize it and make it okay. So then others come and they appreciate it and they can say goodbye. And sometimes if it seems like it's okay, we chant sutra, chant mantras, offer refuge. Important time, just after death, to offer those kind of things. And sometimes it happens that while we're doing all that, the room fills up with sky devas and earth devas so thick you can't wave even a hair anywhere without touching one of them. And they are usually crying. And often we are crying. And everyone's crying. It's a beautiful thing, actually. It's a strong time for everyone. Then someone comes and removes the body and brings it to the crematorium. And when the crematorium is ready, we will return to the crematorium where we have a service. There's actually a cremation ceremony that we perform as we actually, as part of the ceremony, push the body into the furnace. And we say goodbye a second time, chanting, offering incense, usually more tears. By this time, apparently, the devas have gone on to other matters and they seem not to appear at the crematorium. Just us poor human beings are present. Then, sometime later, when everybody can be there and make it for this, we have a funeral service and we carry the ashes into the Dharma hall. We place them on the altar with a picture of the person and the person's name and other things that represent their life. We make Dharma statements. We wave a big flame around while a drum is being played to crescendo, decrescendo, to indicate that we are in this ritual bringing the karmic energy of this beautiful life to a close. We offer precepts, we chant, we take time for family members and other important friends to address the person who has died, and we say to them, thank you, I love you, you were so special, there was never anybody like you before, there never will be anybody like you again. And we wish the person well on their endless bodhisattva journey. And so this is a third goodbye. And then after that, usually more quietly, there's a small service for the scattering or the burying of the ashes. At San Francisco Zen Center now, we've been doing this long enough, we actually have a cemetery in our temples for the many, many lifetime practitioners in our tradition who have passed, starting with our founding abbot, Suzuki Roshi. Many people have come to our house. We live on a big cliff overlooking the ocean, and many Sangha members say, could we scatter the ashes at your house? And we say, sure. So then they come to our house, usually just a few of them, with the ashes. And we ring bells and chant more sutras as we scatter the ashes of the loved one over the cliff. I'm laughing because somehow or other, when we do that, it's not unusual for the wind to be blowing, right? So then the wind is blowing the ashes all over me. I'm scattering the ashes. So the robe I'm wearing is full of ashes of I don't know how many people have passed on. Many. And our house is like a sacred ground now for the many, many people whose ashes are there, some of them buried, some of them scattered. And we say goodbye for the fourth time. But you never stop saying goodbye. When someone you care about has died, you never stop saying goodbye. Every year on the anniversary of their death, you light a candle, you offer incense, you chant a sutra for that person. We never forget them. They live in us. After all, the Buddha nature, the true nature, that in us which awakens, how could that die? It doesn't. It continues. When someone close to you dies, you have to ask yourself, I'm talking about really close people, you have to ask yourself, what work did that person do in their life that they can no longer do, and so I must do it in their name and in their stead? And for many years, after the death of my dear friend Rabbi Lou, who died suddenly in 2009, January the 9th, 2009, or January the 12th, 2009, I would tell the story, which I will not tell you again, but I basically it comes down to, what did he do that he could no longer do? And I realized that what he did that he could no longer do was he was very compassionate and caring. He really cared. You know, he would get upset when people that he loved were in bad shape. And I realized, you know, I'm not too compassionate. I'm not caring. I'm, you know, always thinking about something else. And I mean, I feel sorry for somebody, but I would never get upset. So I realized I have to start doing that on his behalf because he can't do that anymore. And that's when I started really practicing compassion. That's why. That's why I wrote Training in Compassion. Because I knew that I needed to do that in his name and on his behalf, because he couldn't do it anymore. So probably something like this will happen to you maybe someday when somebody passes away and you think, what must I now do from now until the rest of my life in his or her name, in his or her stead? So the Buddha passed, and the Malas honored his body in the Sal Grove with a full week of singing and dancing and music and flowers for a whole week, celebrating the life and the passing of the Buddha. And on the seventh day, the council of chiefs of the Malas tried to lift the Buddha's body, because the Buddha's body was there the whole time they were partying, you know. And then the week was over and they were going to pick the body up and take it on to its next place. The southern gate of the city to a secluded place for burning the body, but they couldn't lift the body of the Buddha. It was too heavy. They couldn't lift it. So they said to Aniruddha, do you know what's going on here? I mean, like, the Buddha was a big person, but we ought to be able to lift his body. And Aniruddha said, well, the reason why you can't lift the body, it's because you have one intention and the devas have another intention. And the chiefs said, what's their intention? And Aniruddha said, they think you should not carry the body out of the southern gate into a secluded place for burning. They think you should carry out of the north gate all the way through the city. And so they tried to do that, and lo and behold, now they could pick up the body, and they went through the north gate and all through the city. More dancing, more singing, more joy, more hurling of flowers. And when they did get out of the city on the north side, they then dealt with the Buddha's body as instructed. While all this was going on in another location, Mahakashapa, who we remember we brought up the other day, the Buddha's in Zen tradition, Mahakashapa is the Buddha's direct disciple, Dharma heir. He is with a company of 500 monastics, and they happen to be going on their way to Kusinara. And they met a monk who was carrying a flower. "Where did you get that flower?" And the monk said, "I got it from the procession that was honoring the Buddha's body." And that's how Mahakashapa and these 500 monastics learned that the Buddha had passed. They didn't know it. And many of them fell into a deep grief, but Mahakashapa said to them, "Didn't you hear what the Buddha was saying, like, all this time? This thing about impermanence and all that? You weren't paying attention to that? You didn't hear that? What, you're surprised? What's wrong with you? Why all this gnashing of teeth?" Meanwhile, back at the place where the Buddha is, it's time to light the funeral pyre. They got the whole thing set up, and they try to light the funeral pyre. It won't light. They can't. They try everything, you know, rolled up newspapers, the whole, they make a little, whatever they can do. They can't light the funeral pyre. So they go to Aniruddha again. They say, "What's going on?" And of course, Aniruddha said, "Well, it's because you have one intention and the devas have another intention." What is the devas' intention? They don't want the funeral pyre to be lit until Mahakashapa arrives and has a chance before it's burned to pay homage to the Buddha's body. So the chiefs wait, and sure enough, Mahakashapa arrives, circumambulates the Buddha's body three times, at which point the funeral pyre spontaneously ignites with a giant flame. After the Buddha's body was burned, many rulers and leaders of communities came and explained very carefully why their place was the rightful place, the most convenient place, and all in all, the best place for the stupa with the Buddha's remains. Many people came, many leaders came and said, "No, you know, this is no good over there. You should put it over here in our place." So what did they do? They divided the ashes into various parts, eight parts, and eight different stupas were erected in eight different places, all of which I think by now are lost. I don't even know if we even know where those eight places were. This, by the way, if you're thinking about this is one great advantage of cremation. They say you can't be in more than one place at the same time, but actually, if your body is cremated, you can be in at least eight places or more at the same time. Suzuki Roshi's ashes are interred at the top of the mountain above Tassajara Monastery with a gigantic triangular stone, beautiful stone that was hauled up the mountain to serve as his gravestone. But also his ashes are interred in Rinzhouin Temple, where he was abbot for many years. So he's buried twice, two places. And it's nice to have a place where you can go to feel the presence of a departed loved one, a pilgrimage place where you can go. It's really nice. I have that place for my parents. I go there when I can. And Rabbi Lu's gravesite, I go and visit. Before he died, the Buddha said if people wanted to seek his presence, they could go to the place of his birth, to the place of his awakening, and his parinirvana, and his presence would be there too. So people nowadays do go, and you feel that, you know, if you go to Bodh Gaya, or it's funny, you know, in these modern days, it's like there's no escape from the tourist dollar. So the Indians are always cooking up like better ways to live. When I went to India, I haven't been there since the 90s. When I went there in the 90s, there was nothing at Kusinagara where the Buddha passed away, but now they're developing Kusinara as a tourist site for Western Buddhists to go to. But as we know, the actual presence of the Buddha is not to be found in Bodh Gaya or someplace like that. It is everywhere. The Avatamsaka Sutra very explicitly says, if you want to find out the place where the Buddha actually dwells, it is on every atom of space. And you feel that sometimes when you're sitting on your meditation cushion. You realize, this is the place where I'm sitting right here. This is the place where the Buddha sat when he came to full awakening and when he passed from this life. So I will conclude my weekend of yakking about all this by quoting to you at the end here from the Mahayana version that I mentioned, I think, on the first day, that there's a Mahayana version of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, usually referred to as the Nirvana Sutra, that is thousands of pages long. So I'm going to quote a few pages, very different, as you'll see. At that time, the world-honored one once again addressed Kashyapa, this is a celestial bodhisattva, saying, Kashyapa, the body of a Tathagata is a permanently abiding body. It's an indestructible body, an adamantine body. It's not a body sustained by food of any sort. In other words, it's a Dharma body. And the Bodhisattva Kashyapa said to the Buddha, world-honored one, I do not see anything like the body that you have just described. The only thing I can see, meaning you're sitting in front of me, the only thing I see here is a body that is impermanent, destructible, made up of atoms, which does consume various kinds of food and so forth. And why do I see that? Because I see that you are about to enter nirvana. I see that you're old and sick. So what are you talking about? And the Buddha said, Kashyapa, now you must not say that the Tathagata's body is not solid, that it is subject to destruction like the body of an ordinary person. Good man, you should be aware of the fact that the body of a Tathagata has become hardened and difficult to destroy over an immense period of time, hundreds of millions of kalpas. It is not like the body of a human or a god, nor is it the body bound by fear, nor is it the body that consumes any sort of food. The Tathagata body is a body, and it is not a body. It was not born, and it will not cease to exist. It does not learn, and it does not practice. It is immeasurable and boundless. It leaves no footprints. It does not discern things and has no forms to discern. It is utterly pure. It has no movement. It is neither passive nor active. It is non-abiding and non-becoming. It is unflavored and unmixed. It was not created. It has no karma and no karmic fruit. It does not move. It does not disappear. It is not a thought, nor is it a number. It is inconceivable, and it will always be inconceivable. And it has no consciousness in the usual sense. Its thoughts are impartial, neither separate nor not separate. It is not, and it is. It has neither coming nor going, yet it does come and go. It cannot be destroyed, damaged, removed, or cut off. It does not come into existence, and it does not go out of existence. It does not dominate, and yet it is dominant. It is not being, and it is not non-being. It is not realized, and it is not observed. It cannot be put into words, and yet it is not non-linguistic. It is neither definite nor indefinite. It cannot be seen, yet is clearly visible. It is without any location, and yet it is located. It is without any resonance, and yet it resides. It is without darkness and without light. It has no quiescence, and yet it is quiescent. It possesses nothing. It does not receive, and it does not give. It is pure and without stain. It has no disputes. Having cut off all disputation, it resides without any place of residence. It neither takes nor falls into a samsaric existence. It is neither a dharma nor a non-dharma. It is neither a field of merit nor not a field of merit. There is no exhausting it. It cannot be exhausted. And it is totally separate from all possible ways of ever being exhausted. It is empty and yet completely dissociated from emptiness. Although it does not permanently reside anywhere, there is no cessation of its thought stream. It has no stains. It is without words, existing apart from words. It is not voice, it is not speech, and it does not learn. It does not weigh, and it does not measure. It is neither unified nor differentiated. It is neither an image nor a characteristic, though it is adorned with external characteristics. It is neither bravery nor fear. It has no quiescence. It does not become quiet. It has no heat. It does not warm. It is not visible. It has no external form. A Tathagata saves all living beings and yet does not save anyone, which is why he is able to save all living beings. He does not liberate anyone, which is why he liberates living beings. He does not awaken anyone, which is why the Dharma he preaches fully accords with reality. He is non-dual and therefore immeasurable, unequaled, evenly consistent like space, completely without shape, of the same nature as non-arising. Anyway, I could go on like this for quite a while because there are many, 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 many pages that go on like in this way. But I just wanted to go on long enough till smoke started coming out of your ears. So that's the end of our discussion of the Parinirvana Sutra. Anyway, that's the end of my things to say. Now we have about 20 minutes for your thoughts, and I'll try to respond if I can to what you bring up. Thank you very much for listening to all that. It's wonderful. We all went to school, you know, and we have the idea of learning stuff. But to study a sutra together is not learning stuff. It's a practice itself, right? It's just the same as meditation. So we benefit. Whether we remember a word of it, it doesn't make any difference. You know, there's a virtue in the ritual of bringing up the teachings and sharing them together. So I feel very lucky that you have invited me to be able to do this. And it's wonderful for me. I enjoy it. I love the teachings and I love this sutra. I've read it many times. And it's very moving, isn't it, to see how the Buddha is in these last months of his life. Anyway, what would you like to talk about? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good heavens. Yes. Yeah.
So it's a different kind of ritual.
Thanks for sharing that, yeah. Thank you. Today is the 1 year anniversary of his death.
We buried him on October 15th.
Yes.
With the exception of calling on Jesus and saying that I love him, I feel a little bit like I'm pushing away a part of me in a way, but I embrace the Buddhism so much that I'm almost not wanting to practice any of what I grew up with. So I have a little conflict with that, and I'm not sure how to resolve it within myself.
Well, I don't know, you got to figure that you are a person in process. So you just sort of pay attention to your own heart. So now you're saying that you feel now that the way you're practicing now gives you a feeling that you're abandoning maybe your childhood or your religion or somehow being untrue to your parents or something. So notice that feeling and pay attention to it. I don't think you need to feel like it has to be resolved, but just pay attention to it and stay with it and see what happens in the future. You may find, surely you'll find that you'll change, right? Your attitude will change, and either you'll feel like, oh no, I'm not abandoning my childhood, or you might feel like now's the time for me to go to church. Now it's right for me to go to church, and I've been thinking about it all this time, and now's the moment. So you don't know what'll happen, but I think the important thing is to be honest and just remember that you're in process. You don't need to have answers to things. You need to just be aware of what your feelings are and follow your heart and see what happens. So, yeah. And, you know, I think that when you think about it, it's very natural that every community will have norms and expectations. So from the point of view of the Buddhist community, it might feel like, even though nobody's going to give you a hard time, you might feel like, well, you know, it's from the point of view of my being in this community, it seems weird for me to be going to church, you know. Similarly, if you went to church and you said, well, I'm going to, mostly I practice at the Buddhist center, they might not feel like that's a good idea. And that's why we feel conflicted, because, you know, the communities that we're part of may put us in that bind. But in the end, you know, we have the confidence to know what's true for us. And when we have that confidence, then the people in those communities will also have that confidence too. In other words, you find out that, well, I thought that they were felt funny about me because I was going to the Baptist church, but now I realize that it was because I felt funny about me, that they felt funny about me. Now that I don't feel funny about me doing that, everybody seems to be fine with it. And usually you find vice versa. I mean, there are more and less narrow-minded religious groups, right? And there are some groups that really do. What? What? You know, you did what? But I think, in general, really spiritual people have good hearts, so they will understand, and you trust that, and you trust mostly trust yourself, so you'll figure it out. I'm sure you will. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. There was two things that struck me. I just wanted to clarify. One was, I heard you say that thoughts and emotions are in the third foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so important, because when people are like struggling with practice, how to sort of place thoughts and emotions is so important. And I felt like I've been taught that they were in the fourth foundation under the category of mind objects, you know, dhammas, mind objects. So I wonder if you could clarify them being the third, because I always sort of thought that was more a coloration of consciousness.
Yeah.
And then secondly, in terms of, I thought, I love what you said, that the fourth was deep patterns of illusion and awakening.
Yeah.
And that really hit me because, you know, the fourth, there's these five groups. There's the hindrances, the aggregates, the sense doors, and then the fact of awakening and the
Four Noble Truths. Exactly. Right. Right. Well, of course, there are various approaches to the Mindfulness Sutra, right? And this is the wonderful thing about religious teachings, is that their subject, of course they would be, the most important and deepest things that are true are always subject to interpretation. So I would not want my that, so I was giving you my interpretation very, very quickly and shorthandedly, and I was not trying to argue for it or explain it much. I was just sort of going through my interpretation that's come from my study of the Mindfulness Sutra over the years. However, I would not want to contradict the interpretations that you might have studied and that your main teachers are giving you. So I do not want to mess you up with my interpretation of the Mindfulness Sutra. Yeah, yeah, okay, good, good, good. But I don't want, so I think you know you should realize that that's just my particular way of looking at it as I've thought about it and practiced it over the years. But exactly what you say, the fourth foundation lists all these lists of teachings that are given everywhere. And when you think about what those lists are, they amount to that. That now we see that the deep human patterns of delusion. I mean, I didn't think of this before, but now that I think of it, one of my themes this weekend, it looked like, was enlightenment and unenlightenment as being one thing. Well, in the fourth foundation, you have the unenlightenment of the five hindrances and all that, and you have the Four Noble Truths and the seven limbs of enlightenment all in one package. And they're the same thing. The Dogen says, to be deluded throughout delusion is called enlightenment. To really understand delusion and human confusion is awakening. So to understand the deep patterns of human confusion, because at first you think, it's me, what's wrong with me? You know, like, oh no, I'm so terrible. Then you realize, no, it's not that I'm terrible, it's like I'm a human being. That's the problem here. And we're all like this. And when you feel that way, then it's different. It's very different. You don't take it personally anymore. And you understand, oh, I'm glad I'm so confused. Now I understand my cousin Harry. So my interpretation is that right, that the third foundation is emotions / feelings, emotions and thoughts. Being able to be mindful of all the stuff that goes in the mind without, you know, the trouble with our thinking and our emotions is we personalize it. This is, you know, of course I'm right. This is what I think. But no, we realize thinking arises in the mind. It comes from who knows where, and it's not mine. That's mindfulness. I'm aware of it. I see it coming. I see it going. I'm not necessarily like so strongly identified with it. I see it come and go. I understand its pattern. I understand its sources. I understand the effects of thinking and feeling this way, these emotions on me, and so on and so on and so on. So that was my interpretation. And if it's helpful, great. I hope it's helpful. But like I say, you know, every tradition and teacher has their own way of approaching that sutra, if they teach that sutra, and you should make use of, you know, the way that you practice in your center, because everything is organized around, it all goes together, right? So the only thing, I just don't want to mess you up. So, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Norman. I wanted to share a story. I love the part about when people die and you carry on their work. And my dad was a physician. That was one of the salient characteristics of him from my perspective. And he died when I was 16.
Ooh.
And then I was on staff at the Forest Refuge at IMS in Massachusetts, and you know, a few years ago. And a yogi came up to me in silence, and she said that her hearing aid had come apart in her ear. And one of the other staff people had tried to get it out, and it went deeper in, and the staff person said, "I'm not going to help you. You have to go to the, you know, medical center."
Yeah, yeah.
She really didn't want to leave retreat. She was deep in concentration. I said, "Well, you know, give me some tweezers." So she tilted her head up to the light, and I reached in there with the tweezers and just plucked this tiny piece out of her ear. And I started to cry. I started to cry immediately, I think because of her concentration and faith and just openness to the procedure. And also, I just started, it was in June when my dad had died, you know, 30 years earlier, kind of around the time of the anniversary. And I started to cry, and I said, "My dad would be so proud." And I think I think the thing about carrying on their work is that we can maintain that connection with
Right, them. Exactly. Exactly.
It's like he was there,
right.
And she was there, right. And she said, "Well, you miss him, huh?" I mean, it was very cool that she was so, she'd been there a couple of months in silence, and so we had an interesting connection, and my dad seemed like he was there.
Are you a physician, too?
No, I have no training whatsoever. That's the thing. There's an innate interest and a lot of conditioning from his influence, but...
That's a wonderful story,
I just
like
to take out splinters
and
shoulders if they're doing this. I go, "Oh,
yeah,
dad,
yeah, yeah."
And I feel like that's a connection.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's beautiful, yeah. And it's as if the person really is there. Yeah. Well, maybe we talked a lot, right? In 2 days, 2.5 days, we many, many words. So, thanks, Lauren and Jason for, is that right, Jason? Did I get it right? Yeah, Jason, for taking care of me. And Rob, is that your name? Did I get it? Yeah. I'm getting really bad on names. I'm glad I got that. Yeah, all of you who took care of me, and Joe and Lee especially, who feed me and take me everywhere and make sure that I get here not too late. So I always have a wonderful time at Sims, and I hope that I will live long enough to come back again. So take care. And those of you who have the time and the space and want to come to the poetry reading, 6 o'clock at Open Books, which is in Wallingford. Open Books. We're going to go right over now to there. So thank you. See you next time. Take care of yourself. Everybody take care of your practice. And let's all of us take care of the world, little by little by little, right? My friend Issan Dorsey always said, little by little, little by little. So that's the way, little by little. Thank you.